and put down God's word. You just don't want to have anything to do with being right.
Do scoffers exist today?
Yes.
Surely there's nobody who would mock God's word today. Yeah, of course. And they always have been. They always will be. And certainly this idea presented here, we'll look at verse 8 now. In Proverbs 29, scoffers set a city aflame, but wise men turn away wrath. How do scoffers set a city aflame? What do they do? Through their tongue, absolutely. Go ahead.
I was just saying gossip.
Good. They mock God, they mock His ways, and they are incredible troublemakers because of it. They're not satisfied just to have that disbelief themselves. They have to speak it, and they bring attention to themselves. They stir up trouble. So not only do they not care about God's ways, they're very apt to entice others to be ungodly too. They won't just leave well enough alone. They want to spread this problem and this strife. They bring destruction. In comparison to that, how are wise men presented? What do wise men do?
They turn away from
it. They turn away wrath. Yeah, and specifically in the context, when scoffers set a city aflame, when they stir up wrath, whose wrath do they really stir up?
God's.
They're
defiant.
Absolutely. And the rebellion, the defiance, it stirs up God's wrath. So on the opposite side of that, wise men turn away wrath. Specifically whose? God. Why do they turn it away? Or how? Maybe that's a better question. How do they turn it away?
By reproving.
Yeah. They are, where the others are rebellious, they are obedient and they are humble to His will. They reprove wickedness, rebuke it, and so they turn away His wrath. Very, very good thoughts. So instead of wrath, what do they bring? Through their wisdom. It's God's wisdom. We understand that. But instead of wrath, what comes with them?
Peace,
wisdom, harmony, all of these things. So you see two polar opposites here. Good. Verse 9. If a wise man contends with a foolish man, whether the fool rages or laughs, there is no peace. We've mentioned the idea before. There comes a time when you have to knock the dust off your feet and move on. It is a sad time. I imagine most of us here who have been Christians for a while have gotten to that point where you have said all that can be said, and you have explained all that can be explained, and a heart is so hard that it doesn't want to hear it, and then it's just time to move on. It doesn't mean you lose any love for that individual. You pray for them, and as you have opportunities, you continue to try to influence them. But the truth is, my energies could be better spent somewhere else on a heart that's not so hard. You move on and go and try to teach someone else. The gospel is powerful enough to change whom? Anybody. Anybody who will do what? They have to let it. The gospel is extremely powerful. We can go, we can see what Paul says about it in Romans 1. It's like dynamite, spiritual dynamite. But you have to let it in. If you don't let it in, it doesn't matter how powerful it is. God has given me free will. He has given me the ability, if I so choose, to reject that power. And many do. And so it's incredibly sad. They must let it. And here you've got the example of a fool. There are some who are so caught up in their foolishness, they will not allow the gospel to prick their hearts. They will not allow it to change them. When you try to correct such a one, someone whose heart is hard, what if you're gentle? Does it work? If they're hard-hearted?
No.
No? What if you're firm? Does it work?
No.
And I think that's the point here. When their heart gets to that point, it doesn't matter if you're gentle. It doesn't matter if you're firm. They're going to have to allow it to pierce their heart, or it's just not going to have any effect at all. You cannot force those who do not want to learn truth. A lesson I need to learn myself. Very well. Go ahead, Norris.
I just think it's sad that some people are convinced that God can't change them, and that they're so bad, they've done so bad things in their life that He can't change them. But like you said, their heart won't allow them to even get themselves changed to.
And what a shame if anybody could ever come to believe that the gospel couldn't change them. I mean, we certainly see examples. I always think, and this particular example under the old covenant, but I think of Manasseh. I mean, all the bad things I've done, I don't think I could ever be accused of filling a city full of innocent blood from one end to another. He was, and he earned it. I mean, he well deserved that description, and yet he repented. If Manasseh can repent, well, certainly I can, and certainly others can. Now, I don't want to leave this verse just like that because it's a little sad. What do you do in the case of someone whose heart who is hardened like this, the fool? What do you do in that case? Okay. Don't forget about them. Pray for them. Continue to be a good example and a light, and continue to do what's right, because sometimes time does change things. People, I think of, and I mentioned to you before, the first time somebody presented the gospel to me, they were just like throwing rocks at a steel wall. I saw no need whatsoever because I was fine. I'm fine. You're fine. We're all fine. It don't matter what we believe. Let's not get technical about that baptism stuff. Everything's okay. And it just had no effect on me whatsoever. 4 or 5 years later, I hear it again, and I'm willing to listen. So time can change things. Pray for time for them. Pray for opportunities. But still, sometimes we need to teach others as well. Yeah. Any thoughts? I saw a hand there.
No, about that. People don't realize that the gospel is something that people teach you. It ain't just something that you just accept right away. You know, and I think sometimes people don't allow themselves to give people the opportunity to teach them the gospel. Because, you know, in the world we live in, you know, in the denomination world, you just go to church. You know, and that's the most that people see. But, like, you got to be taught the gospel.
You know, and I think with the religious world the way it is, and I'll just speak for myself, part of my problem was I had to be untaught all of the error that I had been taught first before truth could really take hold. The best thing in the world is to find somebody who has very little religious knowledge, but they have an interest. It's easy to teach someone like that. Someone who has been raised in error and had it ingrained, it's tough because you gotta remove all that stuff first before truth can really take hold and start to grow. So, yeah, Norris is right. Just the religious world being what it is, it throws a bunch of hurdles in front of us. And we have to be willing and ready to address those. And it takes patience. You know, I don't know why in the world I would think it would be different. I know, especially when I first obeyed the gospel, I would teach my friends, and none of them wanted to be baptized in the first 30 minutes. And I was just like, well, what's the problem? Well, I wasn't either. I just said it took me 5 years before it sank in. And yet, I think sometimes we're so antsy. And you read Acts chapter 2, and there you see thousands of people being baptized. It was a special situation, too. And so much effort had gone to be building to that point. Hearts had been prepared. You've got John the Baptist, who has come ahead of time preparing the way. Then you've got the miracles of Christ. You've got the apostles able to perform miracles. Right there, they're speaking in tongues in front of this whole group. This is a good group of people who are there in Jerusalem doing what they're supposed to be doing, by and large. And so that's a different situation. You know, we get frustrated when 3,000 people aren't knocking down the door to be baptized. You know, we have to take the situation we're given and be patient, treat everyone individually, and address the issues there. Teach. Everybody's not the same. Everybody we study with is going to be different. They're a different place, different background, different knowledge, and we just have to be ready for that. And it takes a lot of prayer, a lot of preparation, a lot of help and advice from brethren who know better than we do as well. Good. Any thoughts? Yeah.
Sometimes when you're praying for that fool, you need to pray seriously and hard that God will bring them whatever it takes to change their heart. And a dear friend who's a gospel preacher, his son had gone away into foolish thinking and had left his wife. And his prayer to God was, do whatever to him that he needs to bring him back to you. You know, if you have to hurt his body, to bring him low, whatever it takes, just give him the impetus to bring him back.
Yeah. Even if it's crushing, that it would be better to suffer all of these physical problems and a soul be saved than to be able to continue. That's a hard prayer to pray. And I think of people in our own family that were once so faithful and were such good examples, and now they've gone and they're chasing after things that are obviously abominations in God's sight. But from a worldly aspect, they have all the money, and they're good looking, and they're talented, and they're popular. What's it going to take to bring their mind back to God? It may take something disastrous. And you hate that. Of course, you don't tie God's hands. You just allow Him to do whatever. But it may take something severe. Whatever it takes, it's worth it if a soul comes back to the Lord. Is that a great, great comment, Lord? Thank you. Anything else? Those are good. Steve?
Not only do we need to pray for them, but we also need to keep vigilant and looking for opportunities to teach.
Yeah.
A word or two here and there may lead to a greater harvest down the road.
You know, I think a problem comes up sometime, even if we are forced to withdraw from a brother or sister in Christ. It doesn't mean you shun them and treat them like an enemy and a hated person. And I think sometimes that the coldness can creep in and it's almost like, well, I can't stand you. That's not the purpose of withdrawing at all. It is to induce shame. It is. And it's to show there's a separation between you and God, so there has to be a separation between you and me. But do you love them any less? That should never be the case. And I'm afraid many times that sort of creeps in where there's a lack of love there. But what's that going to do? If they weren't faithful before, you can rest assured they're not coming back now. If I show hatred I don't even want to be in your presence, that sort of thing. We should continue to have that open dialogue. And they need to know I care about them. I need to make sure that I know that. Now, does it change my relationship with them when such thing? Absolutely. God expects that. But it doesn't mean my love for them fails or is lessened in any way. Great thoughts, Steve. Okay, good. Let's look at 10. The bloodthirsty hate the blameless, but the upright seek his well-being. If you strive to be a person of faith and virtue and righteousness, there are many in this world who will absolutely despise you. They will despise everything that you stand for. Why is that? Go ahead, John.
If somebody's out for blood with you and they can't find any fault at you, at some point in time they got to self-examine themselves and they don't want to do it.
Okay. I think that's it. The darkness hates light. Because what does light do? It exposes, doesn't it? It exposes everything that's there. So everything that's wrong, now it's right there. And if you are shining that light, it is hurtful to the eyes of someone who wants to stay in the darkness. That John's point is spot on there with that. So this is why in the world that we live in, when someone stands up for truth, you just see a heaping on, and the internet helps with that now. It just makes it easy to do that. They just pile on because I don't want to see it. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear truth. Just be quiet and just cover it up and just let me go back to darkness. That's the response of the wicked. But if you have someone who's standing up for truth and doing what is right, what is the response of the righteous toward them? How do the righteous act toward the righteous?
They're looking out for you.
Oh, man. And you could name people, I know you could, when they take a stand, especially against a hard topic or against a hard situation, and they stand for truth, what do you want to do for them? Hold their hands, lift their hands up, stand with them. Yeah, absolutely. They're, you know, we talk about, and I think about in Matthew's and his invitation on Wednesday night, he was talking about standing in the gap. You know, sometimes what we need to stand in the gap is to see somebody else get up and walk toward the gap first. Sometimes we just need a little bit of encouragement. And when somebody else is doing it, then maybe it'll help me get over my fear and realize, you know what, they don't have to stand there alone. I can go stand there too. So you build each other up and you strengthen the righteous, make the righteous better. I think it goes back to a point we looked at a couple of chapters ago. Iron sharpens iron. The righteous make the righteous better. And they love each other and they encourage each other. We see that here. Good. Any thoughts on this one? Matt.
It kind of reminds me of that verse that Paul wrote in Romans, chapter 12:20, about, I think the context is the true Christian doing good to those who are evil, and by doing so, you heat coals on their head, burning coals on their head. Mm-hmm. That kind of makes me think of that verse here in Proverbs about the bloodthirsty man.
Yeah, that's good. Just looking at some of the verses around it there, it's interesting because that comes on the heels of Paul saying, as much as it lies within you, live peaceably with all men. Do everything you can to be at peace with all others. And then he says, don't take vengeance. And then he makes the point that Matt just mentioned there. If your enemy's hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink. For in doing so, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And all of those ideas certainly go together there. Good. Good thoughts. Verse 11, back in Proverbs 29. A fool vents all his feelings, but a wise man holds them back. We could probably spend the next 30 minutes talking about this. We won't, hopefully. But this is... this is an issue every one of us has to deal with. Some more so than others. But in anger, what does a foolish man do?
Let's just come as a
He drops it like a bomb. He just explodes at the drop of a hat. And all of his emotions and all of his frustrations, they just come flying out. And they're like daggers just slung wherever they'll go. Have you ever done that? Ever said something in anger that you wish, as soon as it leaves your lips, you just wish you could reach out and grab it? It's too late then. Or your fingertips if you're typing an email. You wish you could recall it, but you can't because it's out there. And then it's just setting fire to everything it hits. That is what a foolish man does. He just slings his passion out there and lets it mow down anything in its path. What do the wise do?
Yeah. Maybe they sit on it overnight and think about a better way to say it than to just let it go right then.
They consider before they speak. They weigh the evidence. Because there's sometimes when a conversation is going on, you want to respond right then, but it may be better to weigh and make sure you have the right. Could you be wrong? Could I be wrong? Yeah, I mean, I need to make sure that I have all of the facts straight before I say anything, really. The wise are calm. They're thoughtful. It allows them to react rationally and wisely, sagely. God gave us emotions. We don't need to take away from that fact. He did. He gave us emotions. But some people let their emotions control them. God expects us to control our emotions. And that's a very, very big difference in those two things. We're going to talk later about some of the negative qualifications for elders. One of the things we'll look at is not being quick-tempered. I think this goes right in line with that. An elder over the Lord's people, a shepherd, he cannot be quick-tempered. Because what's going to happen?
They're not going to be able to reel back in the flock. They're going to fight with him.
Boy, what chaos elders could cause in a congregation if they are quick-tempered. Just what a mess. Would you trust them anymore? You see them blow up like that? It's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to trust them when they could just completely destroy the harmony of a group, just as John mentioned. So these are our issues, certainly, we've got to deal with. Good. So what do you do? I mean, it's easy to say that. What do you do when it comes? When the moment comes and you can feel the heat and it's just rising from your feet and you, you're ready to go, what do you do? Matt, go ahead.
And you may want to... walk away for a little while.
Yeah.
Because it's, and then just what I say is, I think it's even harder today for us with us. Because I think you can learn how to maybe control your tongue when you're speaking to people. But you talk about emailing with social media, you could lash out, and because I think I have bad problem is text messaging, emailing, Facebooking, that your way of your words coming off. And that's the tough thing with social media is people aren't hearing you speak.
Yeah.
They're reading your words, so they don't understand that maybe you're not being sarcastic. Maybe it is heartfelt, but they still, I've had people respond to me, and I was like, you know, I'm not trying to be mean about this, or whatever it's about. You know, mine's probably more about texting clients or whatever. But still goes to say, you know, because that's what we face in today's world. You know, texting people, and we're Facebook messaging people, and message boards, and all this stuff that we're involved in, and you get in discussions. I've been in religious discussions with people, and you can really come across the wrong way, and they never hear you speak, and they don't understand that you're sincere and heartfelt because of how you put your words. You're typing, and this is what's in your heart, and this is what, you know, if you're talking about the Bible, you know, you're putting verses down, but if you go back and read, especially if you back up and go back and read, you can kind of tell, ooh, this is really coming. So it's so hard nowadays, you know, we're just not sitting here talking to each other, whereas you can tame your tongue and do that, but now you got to tame your fingers and your thought process of how you put stuff out to people.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have to be aware of what we do.
In social media, tone often does not come across. It doesn't. And we talk about stepping back and making sure we think about what we say before we speak. Probably need to spend at least twice that much time if you're typing something. Just go. There have been times where I've typed a response, and then I went back and changed it, and I went back and changed it. And finally, I just deleted the whole thing and called them because it wasn't going to sound right any way it came across. And I meant it to sound well, but I, as Matt said, you go back and read it and you're like, ooh, that's not going to go over well. So it's just be wise. Be wise in everything we do because it only takes a couple words to light a whole fire. You can go and see James is attesting to that fact. Go ahead, Don.
Something real quick. I had a friend that typed a response to an email and capitalized the whole thing. And the only thing that they got back is, "Why are you yelling at me?"
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they took the capitalization as hollering at someone.
Yep. It's a new world for a lot of these things. But I mean, I don't want to discourage talking about the Bible through social media. That's the only opportunity for some to talk with people who are on the other side of the world. So we use it. Just be wise. Be wise and don't be hasty. I think that's probably where we get into a lot of trouble is those knee-jerk responses. Somebody says something, we're like, ah, boom. And just peel it back. Peel it back and be wise. And make sure we say what we really intend to say. John, go ahead.
I think a lot of that has to do with patience, too.
Yeah, it does.
Because old social media was sending somebody a letter. and you couldn't go back and change that when it's in the box.
That's right. That's right. I think another issue that goes with this, and again, I don't want to exhaust us talking about this, but I think pride is a problem. I think pride is one of the reasons why that tone is taken the wrong way. And maybe it's my own pride in not giving it the time to check what I'm saying before I say it. So, you know, all of these things run together and they make a mess if they're allowed to run free. Good. Wise man holds them back. He considers before he speaks. Okay, verse 12. If a ruler pays attention to lies, all of his servants will become wicked. Rulers set a precedent. If a king's servants see that he is always going to do what is lawful and truthful, are they going to bring garbage to him? Are they going to try to get him to do deceitful things? Oh, no. No, he's shown. Or they may try it once. But when he's shown that he's going to stand up for truth and he's going to do what's right, well, then his servants aren't going to be doing this garbage to his face, at least. He's setting a precedent that I'm going to do what's lawful. Now, what if he does the opposite? What if he listens to the lies? And what if he does allow the underhanded stuff under his own actions? What does that do for his servants? Yeah. Well, surely we can do it. If boss does it, surely it's fine for us to do it. It's sort of a trickle-down integrity or lack thereof. If there's integrity at the top, and that's the example, there's a good chance that some of that will trickle down to the servants. If it's lacking, And that's going to trickle down too. And so the same effect is going to come on the servants there, just in the opposite way. Yeah, Matt.
Yeah, I also think that those with the integrity at the top and honesty, they don't, I think who they have underneath them have those qualities. You know, they don't say a ruler appointing officials underneath him or a company with a boss, you know, his character traits, he tends to look for probably those underneath him, you know, so they wouldn't be those deceitful type people. And if they are, he probably, unless he's falling into the trap and doing it himself or herself, probably gets rid of those people because of what his character is and what he believes. And then vice versa for those that are deceitful and wicked, they probably their character is, and they put those under them because those with high character don't want to work for someone like that or be an official for someone like that because they probably have a conscience that they're convicted it's wrong.
Yeah. I'm not a ruler, but can I make some individual applications from this? Yeah, John?
A ruler is usually going to have some rules of conduct. Whether it's an employer or authority figure, they're going to say, here's what I expect, here's what I need of you, and if you fall outside of it, here's what's going to happen to you.
Yeah.
You know, God's got rules for us.
He does.
You know?
Yeah. What was that? Go ahead, Angela.
I was just going to piggyback on what he was saying. It doesn't even have to be someone that works for you or in that sense, it could be the friends that you choose, the people you choose to be around on a daily basis can tell a lot about your character. You have to be very careful about who you associate with.
That's what I was thinking, kind of where I was going with that. It, you know, I may not rule a kingdom, but I can very much be influenced by those I spend the majority of my time with. And hopefully I'm a good influence on them. But, you know, we see the warning of what bad companions can do. And that is true. Again, we've talked about it before. You don't just completely shun and turn your nose up at those. You want to be a good influence on others. But I don't have to constantly spend all my time with bad influences either. That's going to have a negative effect on me. And I think now, especially having kids, if my children see me spending the majority of my time with less than savory characters, and I spend more time with them, my rough college buddies, than I do with my brethren, what precedent am I setting for my kids? What am I I'm teaching them a lesson. What is the lesson?
Not important to put yourself around godly people.
That's it. It's these guys are fun, and I've had fun with these guys for 25 years, and I would rather be around them and their worldliness than around my brethren and their godliness. I may not intend to teach that lesson, but I am. I just did. And will they pick up on it? Absolutely will. So I do think we can make some applications from this idea to we non-kings and queens too. Which, and Matt made the point, we are rulers of our homes. So, in a sense, that is true for us as well. Good. Let's see. Verse 13. The poor man and the oppressor have this in common. The Lord gives light to the eyes of them both. No matter our station in life, no matter our popularity, no matter our possessions, one thing is true of all of us, and what is that? God made us. God made us. And He cares about us. He has given us, well, He's made us in His image, which means He's given us an eternal soul. He's also given us an intellect far above the animals. It would be nice if all of us actually used it, but not the case all the time. He expects us to. He's given us all of these things, the ability to reason and wisdom, as John mentioned. He will judge all of us, and it will be impartial. He will judge all of us the same. Look there, the poor and the oppressor will both be judged by the same standard, God's Word. They will be found lacking, or they will be found in harmony with it. I guess the idea here, that one thing I think we could take from it, I don't need to think myself better than anyone else. I also don't need to think myself worthless in comparison to anyone else. The same God who made them made me and gave me an eternal soul just like theirs. I have worth in His sight. I don't need to get too haughty because I'm not better than them either. So these things, just hopefully these ideas ground us. He made us and He made us to serve Him. And then we remember those things and make sure we're in line with those things. Good. Let's look at 15 and 17 together. We looked at 14 earlier. The rod and rebuke give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. Verse 17, correct your son and he will give you rest. Yes, he will give delight to your soul. The rod represents what?
Discipline.
Yeah, corporal punishment, correction, discipline. Rebuke represents verbal correction. So the rod is the physical discipline. Here is verbal correction along with it. Which one do children need?
Both.
Yeah, absolutely. they need both. Mark your places there and turn to Hebrews 12. This is in the context of God chastening His children. Hebrews 12, verse 11. If someone will read that one for us, please.
For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it.
Is that true? Yes, it is true. It is true. We think back to our own childhood. We kind of chuckled about it before. I mean, your parents say to you, this is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you, and you say, please. Yeah. If that was true, you wouldn't do it. You know, those things. But thinking back, and I'm so glad they did. So glad they did. Because if they had allowed me to just do whatever I wanted to, I'd still be doing that. And I'd be in a lot of trouble spiritually more than anything. An undisciplined child will embarrass his parents, but that's probably the least of their worries. Because they fail to teach him self-control. They fail to teach him restraint. Not only is it going to bring shame, it's going to bring suffering because they're going to have to witness him going through ruin in various ways. And many times, parents get dragged into it. I would say almost every time. So it doesn't end up just being the child who's going astray who suffers because of the misdeeds. It ends up being the ones who love him most because what are they trying to do? And they're going to try to help him. You know, they love him. They're going to try to be, and they're going to get dragged into it as well. But a parent who chastens his child, directs him in the right way, we see Proverbs 23 will be rewarded with joy and delight from those things. Any thoughts? Matthew?
You know, you also see it. I'm sure we've all seen it. Some children that we've known growing up, and you see it as a reflection on their parents. And, you know, if I was lost and they were coming to teach me truth, just seeing how their kids behave, there was no way I would hear anything because they couldn't even keep their child under control. And sometimes you see parents in which you see they have a new child or they're raising a child, and sometimes your heart just breaks for the child because you've seen the example that the parents have been. It's kind of like, let this child be something different than their parents. Don't let them learn in the same way. It really can set an example, it can really jade a person if you see a child who's misbehaving. You know, he's gotten everything in life, she's always been able to do whatever she wants, and it's kind of like, why do the parents do nothing to discipline this child? And you see the actions they do and all the things, and it's kind of like, it really can set an opinion about the parent or the child that's going to grow up because you've seen what the parents do.
I remember Dad saying, remember whose last name you wear when you walk out of here. Remember whose. It's mine. So whatever you do reflects on me. Remember that. And it's true. It is true. Good. Good thoughts, Matthew. Yeah, John.
You've seen, you know, sometimes we got to discipline our little one. And, you know, she knows it's coming. And you give it to them and then they give you a big hug. I love you. See, even though you just spanked them, they know.
Yeah. It's, I think I mentioned before, Sasha had a friend growing up, and Sasha's parents would constantly, they want to know where she was going to be and when she was going to be back and things like that. And she was, you know, she was a teenager. She was frustrated about that. And her friend said, I wish my mom and dad cared. I wish I had parents like yours who cared where I was and what I was doing, because mine don't care about either. And so even someone who, you know, I think as a teenager, you're like, well, I just want some freedom, man. Just let me do what I want to do. You have someone in that case who had that freedom, and they realized it was much more hollow than people thought. They wanted parameters. They wanted that, the protection and the love that came with having those lines drawn. And when he didn't have it, he saw someone who did, and he said, I wish I had it. I want to be in that. And going back to John's point, I do think many times children do see and crave those parameters. They know what's expected of them, know where they are, and we need to make sure that we're outlining those clearly as well. Steve?
I was just going to say, that's the peaceful fruit.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Angela? Yeah.
I was just going to say, that's where negative attention comes in. When they're seeking negative attention, it's because you're not disciplining them. They want your attention, so they're going to do something negative. They need those parameters.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen a child that's seeking that?
Oh, yes, I have.
It's, you know, it raises on your nerves, but they are seeking that attention from their parents.
Yeah. It may simply be because I'm not giving that to them. Yeah, Matt, you have something too?
I think the points Matthew made are great, and I think you can use them to, as we're going through the eldership process, and we studied recently about your lesson about believing children. You know, Matthew talking about, why would people that you're trying to teach the truth to listen to you when they see your children unruly? And you can kind of take that to mind and see exactly why God wanted elders to have believing children. Yeah. Because when they're trying to shepherd the flock and say you've got someone falling away or that's fallen away, and those elders go to that person and try to bring them back and show them the error of ways, they look at one of those elders and be like,
good
children. You know, why would I listen to you when your children are unruly and you have no control over them? So I think we just building on Matt's comments to the eldership, to looking at elders and why, you know, God chose that believing children thing. That's exactly why. Because those elders are not going to be effective if one of that in that group has unbelieving children that are just unruly. Yeah.
You know, there are times where God has told us things and we simply need to accept Him because He is who He is. There are a lot of times where what He's told us makes absolute perfect sense. The wisdom is there if we'll just look at it and see it. Now, I think that's a great, great point there. Good. Okay, well, let's stop there. This is a good place. We'll plan to. We'll drop back and look at verse 16, Lord willing, next Sunday.